coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to this evening's episode of The Curious Realm. Chris Jordan here, your host, coming at you in live fashion from Austin, Texas. Man, I hope everybody had a great holiday, a great Chris Hanukkah Kwanzaadon. All of the celebrations converge this time of year, so I hope everybody had a happy respective celebration of their holiday of choosing. I had a fantastic holiday. We had a great holiday here at the new place with the family. It was nice. It was quiet. Plenty of time to sit around and take astrophotography shots and play with the kid and things like that. So we've been frantically recording episodes here. In 2 weeks, we will be live to tape for you guys. As you know, I like keeping my streak alive. Never once in the history of any of my shows since we started doing live, whether it was Dudes and Beer or this, which it morphed into, never have we missed a live show. Never have we done a rerun episode. There's never been a best of. There's never been a greatest hits. There's never been a, hey, Chris has taken the week off. There has always been new content. There will always be new content. So we are booking guests right now and doing pre-records for that. We have Ella Labane coming on next week to talk about Nibiru. And I figured since that happened and the equinox, or not equinox, but the solstice just happened, that of course we would have our good friend Dennis Stone on. He's our guest after the break. We will be talking about America's Stonehenge, the amazing structure in Salem, New Hampshire, that his family purchased, I guess, a generation ago, and he is now caretaker of. Amazing complex full of astral alignments, all kinds of things. So we will be getting into its construction, its storied history. Our guest in the first segment here in just a minute will be Brad Olson. He is the author of the Beyond Esoteric series. We will be talking about megalithic structures, megalithic cultures across the world. What is it that these things have in common? How do these common threads even occur? We will be getting into that here in just a minute, folks. First, before we bring Brad on, let's go ahead and hop on over to our Facebook group for the News of the Week. News of the Week is brought to you by the Curious Realm Facebook group. Stop on by, join the conversation. Thousands of people stopping by every day, sharing stories, swapping articles, swapping ideas of the world around us. Out of popular science, a simple rule variation could move chess out of a stalemate. Interesting concept invented by Bobby Fischer. If you were a chess player, Chess 960 is really interesting. Go check that out. Totally changed the way the game is played. Out of NPR.org, the astonishing vanishing act of the glass frog has been revealed. That was a cool article. Out of Fizz.org, giant laser from, quote, Star Trek to be tested in fusion breakthrough. We announced a few weeks ago. Well, we didn't announce, Lawrence Livermore Labs announced, and we followed up on the news, the fact that we have our first example of positive fusion, first time that we've had a sustained as long as we could sustain it, reaction that actually came out to a positive result, more energy than what was created. So out of The Guardian, New York winter storm death toll at 28 with more snow on the way. That is pretty horrifying. Yeah, I believe it's at 50 right now across the country. And also out of The Guardian, young Sudanese archaeologists dig up history as well as, quote, world's no West knows best era ends. That is just some of the news that is fit to print there, folks. Stop on by, join the conversation on Facebook. Of course, while you're on Facebook, make sure to stop on by and visit the website of our guest, Brad Olson. He is the author of the Beyond Eric series of books. Welcome back to the show, Brad. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me back on the Curious Realm. And boy, I remember back in the days when we did beer. That was fun too.
That's what I'm saying. It was it's been a hot minute since we've had you on, and it has been fantastic to see you out moving amongst the community like we were talking about before the show. You have been out appearing and giving your presentations about Antarctica and other megalithic cultures across the country. So congratulations. I am always glad to see that happen. Always glad to see people growing in their path. So let's I guess start cracking the nut a little bit, man, because last time we had you on, we were talking about possible pyramids in Antarctica, things like that. You had just come back from an excursion over there.
Yeah, that was exactly 4 years ago. I was just getting down to Ushuaia, Argentina, where it was that I had to find passage to Antarctica. I had not pre-booked anything, and that's in the middle of high season right now because it's summer down there and a lot of people have time off around the holidays. We went into some travel agencies. They said, well, you're going to have to wait until the end of February. And our flights were back out of Buenos Aires in February. I said, well, isn't there any other way? And she said, well, one travel agent said there are private yachts that go down there, sailboats at the other pier. The one pier has all the big cruise ships come into it. And then the other pier is the Ushuaia Yacht Harbor. And just went and inquired there and found out that there was room on a boat called Chief One that was run by a Polish crew. So turned out it was 11 Poles and three Americans on that boat for 26 days. And while I'm staying in really close touch with everybody on Facebook, I've seen my other American boatmate several times, and boy, we always relive those harrowing moments crossing the Drake Passage. And
man, I'll bet
throwing up the whole time, practically.
Man, I can't even imagine what it's like to get down to that extreme point on the globe to begin with. But especially not having passage booked. Basically going down and going, well, I kind of got to hack my way through the jungle when I get there. Like, kudos to you for making that happen, because that is an impressive convergence of events to force to occur. Let's just say that.
It truly was. I do think the universe conspired on my behalf for that one, because I really needed to go down there to look into all these subjects that everybody talks about is happening down there. And while I wasn't able to see any of the big motherships or the pyramid poking through the ice or any antediluvian civilizations, I did find some other curious abnormalities about Antarctica itself, and that being that there was a UFO sighting at one of the bases, an Argentinian base, a month before that some people told us about on another Argentinian base. And then did find out that there is a giant no-fly zone around the South Pole where the presumed giant hole in the ice remains. Now, don't go look it on Google Earth because you won't find it anywhere.
But yeah, it's literally a no-fly zone. Like, ain't nothing passing over the top either.
Oh yeah, they're very strict about it too. Yeah. I wouldn't say they'd shoot you down, but you would certainly get a very hefty fine, maybe even lose your plane if you did.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's been, I mean, that's been there for quite a while. And it's interesting because that was one of the first things to happen out of World War II was the Arctic Treaty.
That's right. And it's very curious the timing of that Antarctic Treaty and how heavily pushed it was by the U.S., who was one of the lead architects in putting it together, because it came right on the heels of Operation Argus. And I do explain this in Beyond Esoteric in a chapter called Alternative 1, 2, and 3. And Alternative 1 was, we're going to blow big holes in the atmosphere and let all the pollution out. What a bonehead idea that was. Really, it was a cover story for what I believe they were nuking the old Nazi base, the New Berlin base, in retaliation from High Jump, in which Admiral Byrd and the Armada were routinely defeated.
And when you say routinely defeated, I think that's an important point to get into, because not a lot of people realize that there were a few incursions that Admiral Byrd made into the area. There wasn't just the single trip.
No, he had been down there several times before, and that's why he was recruited to be the admiral in charge of the whole fleet. He actually was the very first to fly over the South Pole and discover the hole in the ice. And he wrote in his journal, a private journal that he passed on to his nephew on his deathbed, who has republished that book. Saying that he flew down into it and it was a different world down there.
Yeah.
So many secrets and mysteries that surround what's going on down in Antarctica.
And there has been, once again, the I wouldn't say full on release, but there's been the image of the supposed pyramid peeking out of the ice. There's been quite a few things shown from LIDAR, that kind of stuff that look to be structures. But we have proof of, and the whole reason to get into Antarctica first, folks, is because Antarctica was not always frozen.
Oh, no. And, no, it was a steaming jungle.
Yeah. And so much so that it even appears on old maps, even other than the Piri Reis map.
That's right.
And is talked about by other civilizations as some place like that we went there. So how do we get to the point of, I guess, just forgetting that, Brad, because one of the things that we've been kind of rabbit holing with guests lately is the concept of exactly how fast we lose the technology. You know, we had the conversation. Hey, Stephen Myers, I told you that I'd bring you up talking about the building of the pyramids and casing stones and things like that, and how like suddenly the casing stones changed. And it's like, go out and find a master woodworker, like hand carve, you know, like I need a wooden Indian, hand carve one for me. I'll sit around and wait. I'll bet you good money that you may come back in a year and maybe not be able to find one, you know? But yet still 50 years ago, We would have been able to find that guy pretty quick, you know, to take a piece of wood artwork or operational furniture to somebody. Like, prime example, my great great grandmother's rocker broke. Good friend of mine who's an amazing woodworker fixed it. Could not find a woodworker that wanted to take it on. Could not. Because the skill of matching that, you know, was hard. It was not easy to like match the kind of wood and the runners and the style and everything else, and not just say, hey, look, I cobbled together some stuff and now your rocker works again, you know? So we as a humanity lose these skill sets rapidly.
Mm.
We lose that cultural knowledge rapidly. I mean, hey, we got a whole generation of people my age right now who are reliving vinyl, and kids are finding out what it is. You know, if you went to a kid 10 years ago and showed him a vinyl record,
let alone try to get him to know how to play it.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing, is even the technology to read the data, like, fantastic. This is a 1 terabyte thumb drive I'm holding in my hand right now. The problem is, I could put like a ton of esoteric materials, things like that, instructions, you know, like how to live on in the middle of a desert on this thumb drive and bury it. Now, the question is, when somebody finds it in 100 years, will they be able to read the thumb drive?
Ah.
Will they be able to actively access that knowledge, that information inside of that technology that for us was commonplace? This is a common thing. You can literally buy thumb drives at the friggin' 7-Eleven.
And digital data does break down over time. It becomes corrupted and unreadable. That's why I believe in books. And I'm a book publisher and an author. And books do have a propensity to last a long, long time.
Yeah.
That knowledge is then preserved.
That's why the ancients carved it in stone. It was so important, they didn't want it to go away for that long. With that in mind, let's start the conversation of megalithic culture. Let's start the conversation of how these cultures began and where they ended up. How did these similarities across cultures occur, you know?
Sure. Yeah, it's an absolute fascination of mine. As I've been traveling around the world, I've now reached all 7 continents. And before the Antarctica trip, I spent several months in South America and had the great opportunity of traveling as one of the guest speakers with Nassim Harriman and Brian Forrester on a trip through Peru and Bolivia, and getting an opportunity to go to all those megalithic sites. It was really a bookend to all the other incredible megalithic sites I've seen in my travels, and coming to the realization that there was a very ancient builder race, that's what it's called now, that worked in megalithic polygonal architecture, that's many angles, but so precisely fit together that even in a location like Peru, which is very earthquake prone, these megalithic structures are unfazed. They don't crumble. What does crumble is the more recent Spanish and even Incan architecture. And it's now widely recognized that the really older, larger megalithic structures of Peru and Bolivia are pre-Incan. And they're still as robust and fitted together as they were. Now, some of them have taken a fall, such as Tiwanaku in Bolivia at Pumapunku. It's almost like a kid's Lego set that they just threw up in anger. But you also have a few parts of Machu Picchu that have a couple fallen blocks. But for the most part, they're largely intact.
Well, in these sites, we got into some of these a couple weeks ago with Jared Murphy. And the idea that there are technologies used at these places, even at things like Pumapunku, stuff like that, where you're talking about, geopolymers being used. That kind of stuff to actively mold the stones. And we're just now discovering geopolymers. We're just now like getting to the point of, understanding the components of Roman concrete. Not the actual formula.
Can't even reproduce it. Yeah.
So, yeah. And those buildings, you know, yes, crumbling, but the aqueducts are still working. It's pretty phenomenal and pretty remarkable. And they were not anything on the scale of your Pumapunku, Tiwanaku, things like that. They were far more, at least, quote unquote, far more advanced of a civilization as far as technology went.
That's very true. And for the most part, these megalithic blocks do not have mortar of any kind. Mm-hmm. They're just so precisely fitted together, they don't even need it. And the fit is so tight. I even tried it with a credit card and a piece of paper. You can't even fit them in the creases. They're still so tightly packed together. And then when you look at some of the angles, really the devil is in the details when you study this megalithic architecture, because some of the angles are just, you would think, so unnecessary to go to that trouble to create an angle that is fitted together. A 90 degree turn in the wall, and the block continues with the other blocks fitting right into it, and then coming into little Y joints, and the piece on top fits right on top of that Y joint so perfectly. This is the polygonal architecture, which is largely regarded as being the oldest in the world. And I do a presentation. I'll be doing it at the New Living Expo in Los Angeles coming up. It'll be my first of, now I'm booked on 10 conferences for 2023. On February 11th, I'll be giving my presentation on the early maps. And you alluded to the early maps showing Antarctica, not just a Peary Reese map. And I'll show a half a dozen others that show Antarctica before it even got discovered. Several centuries later, it was not even discovered and stepped foot on until 1821. So we're just at the 201 year anniversary of Antarctica being discovered. Yet here it is on all of these old sea maps during the Age of Discovery. And then when you combine all of the builder race megalithic architecture around the world, for example, in Japan, was one of the first places I saw overseas with megalithic architecture at the, not only in Tokyo at the Royal Compound, but also the Osaka Castle and around Kyoto at the Nijo Castle and several others. The foundational stones for some of those donjons, the Shogun castles, is very, very old, of a megalithic polygonal structure. That's just Japan. You have scattering of this polygonal architecture all across Europe, from Greece to Albania, several sites in Italy, and also up in France, and a megalithic structures such as Stonehenge in England. Then you have the South American features too. So here you have the same similar style of architecture clearly wrapping around the world, including also the Middle East and Near Asia.
Well, like you're saying, over in Greece, I've got up on screen right now one of the bricks from Pumapunku. And if you think of it in the concept of pouring a mold, let's say, that looks like a fantastic idea for a mold right there. But the main thing is in the center, where these things link together, similar to Grecian columns, where the columns are quite literally carved with the top with a nipple coming out and the bottom with a square dimple for that square nipple to go into, because the Greeks figured out long ago, we can't build solid marble columns. We live on a volcanic island. We have earthquakes regularly. We have tremors, things like that. That utterly cracks, that causes fissures in the marble. But if we build them in stacks of it and interlink them together, they move with the actual motion of the ocean, so to speak. And at that point, you don't have the collapse. You don't have the wear that typically happens. And interestingly enough, when you look at, I mean, things like Pumapunku, stuff like that, all kind of near volcanic activity, all kind of near, you know, mountains, things like that, that tend to move, shift, those kind of things.
Shifting, yeah. Even out on Easter Island, which is this volcanic island that the Moai statues were all built from, the Rinoco crater. But they also have a megalithic wall there, a polygonal megalithic wall with these big stones and then one tiny little one in between that they had to fit the big ones around. So it appears to me, Chris, that this is of the same culture that went ahead and built all of these. So there was a world culture quite a long time ago. And the thing about stones is it's very hard to date them. Carbon dating has to be of a carbon base. So sometimes you can find lichen on some of these megaliths and date it to, okay, 1,000, 2,000 years old. But that's just as old as the family of lichen that had been living on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really unknown how old these are. And they could go back not just thousands, but tens of thousands of years, even before the last ice age and cataclysm that had moved the continents around. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that Tiwanaku and Pumapunku were shattered because they were so old, they were more like down at sea level. In fact, Pumapunku had access to Lake Titicaca. And in Lake Titicaca, there's a very curious freshwater seahorse. No other place in the world have seahorses exist in freshwater. They do live in seawater. So it's presumed that Lake Titicaca had once, which is a volcanic caldera, when it rose up to its present height of over 11,500 feet, that it carried the seahorses with it and it adapted to the changing water becoming more freshwater as the rivers and creeks flowed into the lake.
Yeah, as it lost its brackish quality and became freshwater over time.
Right.
And, you know, once again, a prime example of how the world continues to change around what's happening. And when you live amongst the world in that way, you are intimately connected to that and have that realization. There was a really, really interesting show that happened for a while. I want to say it was Discovery Channel. That was about, when humans become extinct and what will happen to the earth. And it went on for a few years, I think, for a few seasons. But it was remarkable to see things like, without maintenance, how fast our buildings would just fall into disrepair and crumble and go away, and how fast the metal infrastructure would just rust away and be gone.
But you know what's going to remain? The megaliths.
Yeah.
They're going to still be there.
Now, when you talk about this, quote, builder race, are you talking a group of enlightened individuals that were traveling about, or the fact that at one point that this maybe dates back to a point where continents were still colliding and still close together?
Well, that's right. And in my presentation, I also show at the end underwater archaeology. So you have sunken ruins off the coast of Cuba that are very deep that show what looked like a Mayan temple complex. You have Yoguni in Japan, which has fairly recently been discovered only in the last two decades, which is this giant outcrop outcropping of rock that is carved in such a way that there are right angles and steps and platforms that must have been fashioned by humans, yet it's underwater. So the point here is this builder culture would have existed before the last ice age, when sea levels were much lower and these constructions could have been performed before they sank under the waters of the ice. So therefore, we can say that a lot of these builder race cultures are at least 12, 13,000 years old. And really, everything keeps getting dated older and older and older. Graham Hancock has a great new show out on Netflix.
Amazing show. I think I've watched it three times now.
Wow. Yeah, I've had a chance to meet him a few times. Really humble guy, great researcher, credible books, and now this TV series is just phenomenal.
Well, and it's really been interesting to see quite literally some of the backlash from certain communities about it. Because he's always been very, very clear and upfront about his work that I am no scientist. I don't claim to be a scientist. I don't want to be a scientist. I am an investigative reporter, and I am following a story, and wherever things lead me is where they lead me.
Yeah, it's like, right, as you should be. That's the way researchers should take the...
And I'm sorry if I'm willing to ask a question that makes you horrifically uncomfortable, because that is where the evidence has led me. Is to this horrifically uncomfortable question that, may question every bit of what you as a scientist have spent your career studying, what you as a scientist have published works that other scientists are studying off of, everything. But the thing is, you have to be willing to question that.
Of course.
Like, that's a string you've got to be willing to pull, you know, like kind of like the whole question of the hydrogen bomb and the conundrum that they had of, well, I don't know, by all calculation, it could ignite all the hydrogen in the atmosphere. And that wouldn't be cool. And they're like, well, I guess there's only one way to find out.
Blow it up.
Let's lo and behold, we had a hydrogen bomb for a long time. Because somebody in the science room was like, well, I guess push the button, let's find out, you know. But for some reason, when it comes to accepting the concept of this, despite the mass amount of anecdotal evidence, Brad, from cultures across the world, similar construction styles from cultures across the world, similar construction techniques from cultures across the world. We get into this with Stephen Myers all the time. I'm not discounting the intelligence or the ingenuity of anybody at any point in the history of humanity. But does it have to be extraterrestrial in origin? No. It could be, like you're saying, a group of highly intelligent people who are spreading this knowledge to others.
Yeah, I think that's a logical way to look at it.
Well, let's get into a few more of the similarities between these things across the globe and a bit more of the evidence that points to this builder race that you're talking about.
Sure. Well, another really interesting feature of some of these very, very old megalithic structures of a polygonal nature is they are vitrified, that is, exposed to extreme heat to the point where the stone is melted, and there's locations in Scotland with vitrified forts. where you can clearly see that they were built out of blocks or bricks, but have melted on top of each other and fused together. Sites in Egypt and as well as out in the desert, which has big pockmarks of glass showing that when it was the sand was exposed to heat, it was turned to glass. Albania has a site I show in my presentation of vitrified stone on the surface where it too was exposed to great heat. And so it does appear that there was some kind of high-tech war using some kind of a nuclear type of weapon against each other. And turns out that's what was said to have been the downfall of Atlantis, was that there was this war going on between the East and the West, and the Vimana craft of India could fly very quickly. Anti-gravity comes to mind. And they were fighting with the Atlanteans. And as we know, the folly of war, you never really have a winner in such conflicts. And let's hope history doesn't repeat itself with what's going on in Russia and Ukraine right now, because this could turn ugly real quick if those weapons were to be used.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And not too long ago, I was just there it is. I was just telling somebody the other day about the stash of orichalcum that was found underwater. Orichalcum, the famed metal of Atlantis. That many people have thought for years never existed, myth, things like that. Like, no, there are actual examples of orichalcum out in museums, stuff like that. It is an actual metal that is made out of an alloy of copper, bronze, things like that. Absolutely amazing. But one of the many things to show the fact that, no, these stories are rooted in truth. These things that we have, it's interesting to me because there are, especially in numerous cultures, there is a difference between their myth and mythology and their cultural origin. Mm. And very few of them, it is where it is myth and mythology that there was a massive flood. That is part of their spiritual origin.
And a story that's repeated literally around the world.
Yeah.
So these things cannot just be coincidences everywhere else. And as far as going from myth to reality, look, the ancient city of Troy in Turkey was often regarded as just mythology. It was just in the Homer great books of Homer, of ancient Greece, and people thought, oh, yeah, it was just
in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah, that's right. And it wasn't until Shielman did the excavations there in the 19th century and found it that everybody said, well, Troy was a real place. What do you know? It wasn't myth after all.
Well, and what's interesting was when he found the place, a lot of it was because of locals.
Yeah.
Where he went and he asked. Knew it was there. And they were like, oh yeah, I mean that was right over there.
Right.
It was no strange information to them.
And think about all the archaeologists that could have made that find, but just believed the dogma that Troy was a myth. And they missed that opportunity. Shielman was self-financed. He just went out there on his own and wanted to prove to the world that it really did exist. And he struck gold and found it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's and kind of like the not asking the question of how is it that the first Indian that met the English settlers spoke English?
Right. And then there's the Welsh Indians too.
We kind of skip over that one.
Yeah.
You know, so that means somebody else came before them. We don't really teach that. We don't, but it's there. It's there. And it's interesting to see these things popping up more and more. It is fantastic to have seen a vast swath of community who are now open of mind to these topics, to see a show like Graham Hancock's not only, come out to the success and hoorah that it did, being picked up by a network like Netflix, and staying on the top of the Netflix chart for as long as it did, but, also ruffling the feathers the way it did. You know, it's interesting to see now amongst numerous disclosure communities, this want for more and deeper information and not just a trowel scrape of the surface by an archaeologist, you know?
Yep. Yeah, and that's where we got to take this. We got to push the envelope. We got to always keep building on what we know. That's really the only way that we'll finally come to some great realizations that things go back a lot longer than we ever thought. There has been civilization on this planet, I would say millions of years. In my book, Modern Esoteric, I have photos of cogs or bracketed wheels that were found in a seam of coal in Siberia, dated at several million years old, that were obviously of a high-tech manufacturer. These are called uparts, out-of-place artifacts. And I'm sure Dennis Stone in the second hour will tell you about some of the uparts that have been found at America's Stonehenge, including a little well or shaft that had crystals stuffed into it, quartz crystals, just fascinating. And these uparts, usually found in mines, sometimes giant bones, sometimes holding artifacts that don't belong there and certainly not of any kind of time frame that we're given. Oh, all civilizations started in Sumeria. Oh, no, it goes way back. Well, that's already been disproven with Göbekli Tepe and, and now other sites around there that are pre-Ice Age civilizations on Asia Minor that are much older than the Sumerian cultures.
Well, yeah, precisely. And once again, with iconography, with building techniques, things like that, that seem to be reiterated thematically. It's fascinating to see the tie togethers culturally and I guess just technologically in that way. As well as not necessarily the fact that everybody isn't looking up at the same set of stars, but is everybody fascinated with the stars in the same way? So much so as to orient their towns to it, you know, to orient their cultures and their religions to it.
And that's the science of archaeoastronomy, which America Stonehenge has as well. And I've been to the site several times. And please give my regards to Dennis when he comes on. Wish I would have had a chance to say hi to him. But he, I've even met him out there, and he showed me some of the alignments that line up that are not coincidence. You don't have a heel stone such as in Stonehenge where the sun comes up on the solstice right on top of the stone and shines directly into the middle of the trithylons in the middle of Stonehenge. And this archaeoastronomy can be found, once again, all around the world, usually incorporated into the design and the building of these megalithic structures. But you also have things like a wood henge. There's another ancient wooden structure near Stonehenge that they just found the post holes for, because, of course, the wood has been long rotted away. But there are also the medicine wheels out on the Great Plains. And one of the most famous is Bighorn Medicine Wheel in Wyoming, which accurately shows the dating. There's also the Itithwana stone in Machu Picchu, which is also a sundial stone. So when you think about how important it would be to know the seasons, say, for example, at Bighorn Medicine Wheel, if you needed to know when you had to get your people out of Wyoming before the winter storms came, you needed to have a good understanding of the changing seasons, the moving of the celestial bodies, and even predicting equinoxes and solstices. I mean, some of them are very advanced. So we have to give a lot more credit to the ancient people than they've been given, because when you look at archaeoastronomy and how they were able to work this into the actual monuments themselves, it's quite sophisticated knowledge to be able to do that.
Oh, most definitely. And one of the things that we've spoken with numerous times with Dennis Stone about regarding America's Stonehenges, A, when the settlers got there, they asked the Native Americans, "Oh, this is great. When did y'all build this?" "We didn't build this. This was here when we got here."
Right.
Which is remarkable to begin with. But the thing that I've posited is that the native tribes of the Northeast are not prone to building rock shelter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the Pueblo Indians or the Indians of the Southwest, things like that, you know, the mound builders, that kind of stuff. That's not necessarily the kind of Indians they were. They traveled with the seasons, like you were saying. They lived by it. They hunted by it. They grew some wild crops, things like that. And when the season for it was over, they moved on to soil where they could grow the next crop. You know,
and they had to. If you were late getting out of, say, the higher elevations of Wyoming, look what just happened last week with this polar vortex. You'd be dead.
And so one of the things, precisely. And you got to know where you're at and how long you have to get where you need to go, you know, and to have a waypoint. To have something along the lines of America's Stonehenge for a traveling people who are traveling. I mean, these beehive constructions have been found. There's 300 of them in New Hampshire and up to 800 of them across the northeast of the United States and on into Canada.
And that's only what remains. There were many, many more that just got dismantled.
Yeah.
And I love those beehive chambers. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris. Because I've been there several times as well, and many of them have a capstone that's a megalithic structure built right on top of it. In fact, America's Stonehenge has megalithic multi-ton blocks fashioned into its construction as well.
Yep. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we got into not only with Jared Murphy, but in our pre-recorded conversation, you're about to make me knowledge bomb my own episode before it even plays, Brad. But one of the things that I posited with Jared Murphy, because he brought up the altar stone and the fact that the chamber off to the right has a small tunnel that terminates underneath that altar stone. If you say something in the tunnel, it can be heard on top of the altar stone.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that is incredibly reminiscent of ancient Greece, Minoan society. That is how the Temple of Zeus was. That's how the temples in Minoan society were, where they would have a high priest underneath the altar and like a trumpet looking tunnel coming up through the mouth of the god or underneath the god's throne. And you would literally hear the god speak during an initiation ceremony or during a sacrifice. Things like that. So the two things I posited were, A, is that altar stone and that chamber system, that voice chamber system, something like that. Are these initiation sites that are somewhere that are near power centers, what have you, even with archaeoastronomic alignments? And are the beehive caves and structures a peep sighting system?
Well, they
are. Where you can literally back yourself into the cave and remove the light of the moon for your observation.
So at the Gungiwamp complex in Connecticut, there are little peephole windows that only shine the sun through on the equinox. Similarly, at Upton Stone Chamber in Massachusetts, which isn't too far away from America's Stonehenge.
Yep.
That one, too, is also aligned with the solstice, just like in Newgrange, Ireland. There is a triple motif spiral in the very back of the Newgrange complex that is only illuminated during the days before and after and during the winter solstice. So these can't be coincidences. And the fact that you see them popping up into the design of other megaliths on other continents is also good evidence for the builder race.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, for the idea that there was somebody traveling around sharing this knowledge. And when that was a topic that we got into with Jared Murphy, was the idea of like the Dogon had their fish gods. There's the same thing in South American tradition. There's the same thing in Göbekli Tepe. Things like that. And in Sumerian tradition, there are all these motifs that are carried on across the globe religiously and belief wise that are just fascinating, that tie into these construction techniques, that tie into, where they came from and the fact that this god or these people came from across the sea and gave it to them.
It just is so fascinating, and new discoveries continue to pop up and be made every year, and it just continues to add to this body of work showing that there was some kind of high-tech civilization that lived on this planet a long, long time ago, and it seemed that they would share their knowledge. If you go through the history books when we grew up, they would say, oh, the oceans, they're just these barriers. They were insurmountable and people did not exchange information or knowledge. But there's a new way of thinking called cultural diffusionism, that the oceans actually acted more like a highway. And there were seafaring high culture civilizations that would use the oceans to get around. And hey, let's face it, we live on an ocean planet. A lot of people don't realize how big the oceans are. It's 71% of the surface of the world is covered with water. So it's really more of an ocean planet than a continent planet. And if you know how to navigate using the stars, such as the Vikings did and the ancient Polynesians, and use clues like following birds and going along the currents, you can navigate even very primitively. I remember when I was a kid, I read a story of a man who crossed the Atlantic in a bathtub. And then what I really liked was a 12-year-old kid was on a sailfish sailboat and he crossed the Atlantic too. So yeah. It's not that hard. It was a bit of a misinformation that the oceans were barriers, because they weren't. They were more conducive to world travel.
Well, sure. I mean, of course, there are currents that travel across the ocean. There are animals that travel across the ocean faster than boats, because of the combination of their swimming and current, traveling capabilities. And I was bringing up the, image of the Pacific Ocean from space. If you want to get an idea, folks, just Google Pacific Ocean from space. That will give you an idea of the vast amount of water that we know more about outer space than we know about our ocean. We have explored more of outer space and the surface of Mars than we have our own ocean. It's remarkable what is under there. Like we were saying earlier, completely submerged temple complexes, things like that, evidence of things like orichalcum from Atlantis. But when you look at that image of this is just one ocean, the Pacific, it's literally the entire planet. There's Antarctica on the map and some slivers of other things, but it's the entire globe from space. It's massive, massive. Yeah. To understand the way that those currents work, the way that things move, that in and of itself is a technology. And once again, Brad, that can be lost. The idea of you can't do it without a motor. You can't do it without a clipper ship of sails. No, that just made it easier and a little bit safer. Didn't right. make it possible.
No, there are many techniques to sail the oceans, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, where you always had the North Star, a fixed position in the sky that you could always determine your latitude. Now, longitude was a tougher nut to crack. That wasn't actually fully discovered accurately until the 18th century by the Brits, who put out a reward for anybody who could accurately figure it out. And it is also a time clock, and this is how a sextant works for navigators to also make a fix on a certain star, see how long you travel, and then get a fix on that same star after a certain amount of time, and then you're able to tell how far you've traveled along the longitudinal lines. That is from the North Pole, the 24 hours that go down to the South Pole. Latitude, of course, is starting from the equator up the degrees to the poles as well. But once you got into the Southern Hemisphere, of course, all the stars change down there. Then you have the Southern Cross and different constellations that are much different. It's more challenging. And then there's less land masses in the Southern Hemisphere, too. That's why the ancient Greeks proposed there must be another landmass down there. And they were the ones who came up with the name Antarctica, because over the Arctic is the constellation called Arctus, and they named the Arctic region appropriately. And then they said, well, then there must be an opposite to that, the Anti-Arctus. Antarctica is where that name came from.
There you have it. Wow.
Yeah, there's something to leave it on.
Well, and you know, it's the idea that, you know, the ancient Greeks were also some of the first people to say the earth was round.
Yes.
Till about 500 years ago, it was pretty anathema to say just about anywhere in the world. You know, it was pretty well agreed upon that the earth was not round. That if you sailed to that tiny black line on the horizon, you would fall off. You know, what it took was a bunch of people in a room and a dude going, you know what? I'll give it a shot. You know, once again, that guy in the lab with the plunger button going, well, I guess there's one way to find out. Let's push the button.
Christopher Columbus almost had a mutiny on his hands because before they discovered Hispaniola in the Caribbean, yeah, they were getting pretty restless, thinking we're going to fall off the edge of the world. And he had to say, nope, nope, keep going, keep going.
He is, he has taken us to our deaths.
Yep.
And absolutely. Brad, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on. We need to have you on again and again. I always love our conversations. Let everybody know where they can go to purchase your series of books, the Beyond Esoteric series, and where they can go to keep up with upcoming conferences, everything else, because you are currently filling the books for 2023 and travels and conferences. So good for you, my friend.
Well, thanks, Chris. Yeah, if you want to check out the books I write, I'm also a book publisher, some of the other books on our different series, and you can go to cccpublishing.com. That's 3 C's publishing, one word, .com. And if you find out more about me, bradolson.com, and then there's a link with my upcoming conference schedule, which, yep, it's filling up. I think I'm up to a dozen now for 2023. Wow. 3 in the month of March alone.
Hot dog, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's what I love to do, and it's great and well-received when I give my presentations. And I like to meet people, too. So I'll be at my table with my books at all these conferences. And come on over and say hi. I like to meet people and hear your point of view, your perspective. And maybe you can add some to the conversation, too, as to what I was presenting at the conference.
Exactly. And, you know, make sure to stop by Amazon, folks. That is also where you can easily find everything. You can find all of his stuff, of course, on the Curious Realm store, things like that. Brad, once again, thank you so much for answering the call, coming on the show. I will be in touch, of course, with links to all this. It's going out live right now, but will be pushed out to all platforms tomorrow. And take care of yourself, my friend. You have any new research or things like that coming up? Let us know.
Hey, that sounds great, Chris. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and let you go for this evening. We'll be in touch soon.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. Always fun talking with Brad Olson. So great to have him back on the show. Make sure to stop on by his website, bradolson.com. That is where you can find all the books from CCC Publishing. That's where you can contact Brad. That's where you can keep up with his conferences. Of course, while you are online checking out his website, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is our website. That is where you can follow us on social media. That is where you can share your story if you are an experiencer. That is where you can visit the Knowledge Vault and download all kinds of declassified government documents and materials. That's also where you can visit the store. So while we are on commercial break, everybody, get ready. We will be welcoming Dennis Stone, the owner of America's Stonehenge, when we come back from this break right after this.
With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. Thank you so much to WebWorks Wireless for everything that they do for the show. They are our source for streaming to the website as well as live streaming from on location. Stop on by and check them out, webworkswireless.com. They are your home for no throttling, no credit check, live wireless internet anywhere you have cell phone signal. So stop on by and check them out, WebWorks Wireless. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Dennis Stone. He is the familial owner of the property known as America's Stonehenge in Salem, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the show, Dennis. How are you doing?
Oh, Chris, doing very well. Thank you for having me on again. Nice to see you.
Always glad to have you on. As we were laughing about earlier, I don't know. I need to start having more conversations with Jared Murphy or something. For some reason, your name always pops up whenever I have conversations with him, and then I'm spurred to contact you. And we always have you on directly after equinox or solstice, like every time. So I want to have you on before equinox or solstice sometime and actively make a trip up there to check this place out, because it is a phenomenal location. Tell the audience a little bit about your family history with the property and how it came into your hands.
Well, I'd like to say happy belated solstice to you, and we'll have another one this summer. So maybe, and we have the equinox. And so my family got involved with this back in 1955. It was my dad, Robert Stone. He was an AT&T Bell Labs engineer, and he had just got out of the Coast Guard, spent some time up in Labrador for the Coast Guard, right? Not too far from where the Viking site is, Lonzo Meadows. And he had always an interest in history. But he was here in the early 50s. I think it was 1960 that Lonzo Meadow was officially discovered, if you will, and he was a little bit early for that. So after he left there, if he was there during that time, he would have definitely taken a trip over to see Lonzo Meadow, because that, like I say, was one of his passions, you know, history, Native American, Vikings, and maybe old world visitors to the New World. On a Friday night back in 1955, he was listening to the radio. It was a big station out of Boston. It's one of the biggest still in New England. Show called Yankee Arms. And Yankee Arms had a host, Alton Hall Blackington. And he was from Maine originally. And I think that's where he lived. He came down to Boston to do a show, and it was syndicated all over New England. And on this particular night, he was talking all about these strange stone ruins in a town of Salem. Actually, it's in New Hampshire. There is a Salem, Mass. And I think you mentioned Mass earlier. Everybody confuses us with the Salem, Mass. We're about 30 miles from Salem, Mass, about 30 miles northwest. Right in southern New Hampshire, about 40 miles north of Boston. So he's listening to this radio show. My dad only lives about 7 miles away in a town called Derry, New Hampshire. It's where Alan Shepard, the first astronaut, and where Robert Frost, the poet, lived. My grandfather had Robert Frost for a teacher in high school. But he was listening to the show and never heard of these stone ruins. And the show kind of blew him away. He goes, how can I be this close to the place? It's on, you know, the big station in Boston. It sounds fantastic, but I've never heard of it. That following week, he's at a barbershop having his hair done up in Derry. And the barber was Warren Haywood. He used to race horses down at one of the large racetracks called Rockingham Racetrack. Seabiscuit and other pretty famous horses race there. But my dad's looking at a magazine, waiting to have his hair cut. And he picks it up, looks at it, and he's flipping through it. And there's a feature article, and it's about the same place. And it was a magazine called New Hampshire Profile Magazine. And my dad's flipping through it. The barber, you know, is there. And my dad said, hey, can I keep this? He goes, well, how old is that magazine? He goes, it's 1952. It's probably been here for 3 years, you know. And Warren said, take it. The following weekend at my aunt and uncle's in that same town, about 10 people playing cards on a Saturday night. My dad at one point took the magazine out. He handed it to the people that passed it around the table. And nobody recognized what this place was. They didn't know what it was either, just like my dad. And kind of a surprise to everybody. But my aunt and uncle, when they finally looked at it, said, wait a minute, that's where we used to go back in the 1930s. We used to bicycle down there when they were dating. And they used to go up there and have picnics on top of these stone ruins. And so my dad was kind of blown away by that. But he said, hey, can you find a place? And in those days, the site was not open to the public. It was private property. It had been under archaeological research since 1937. So that next morning, my dad, my aunt, my uncle, and my mom, they all rode around North Salem trying to find this place. There was no road signs. You know, we didn't have Google Maps or anything like that. And after a while of driving around, they finally spotted an old road that looked familiar to them. So they parked the car on the main street and they walked up this road. And there it was. The site was on top of a hill. And they were quite surprised because my dad was, you know, totally excited. And he actually climbed underneath the chain link fence that was put up by the first researcher in 1937, Mr. Goodwin. The fence is still there today, 85 years later. It protects the site. But my dad climbed underneath it, and the rest of them stayed outside. And when he came back outside, probably, you know, half an hour later or whatever, they asked what he thought. And he goes, just totally amazed by these stone ruins. never seen anything quite like that. And then he said something to my mom and the rest of them, something like, you know, I'd like to get involved with the research, you know, find out more of what this place is and maybe even open it up to the public as a museum. And my mom's comment was something about you got rocks in your head. So, but eventually they met the owner, Malcolm Pearson. And Malcolm only died about 10 years ago, about 11 years ago at the age of, he was just turning 100 years old. And Malcolm is the one that my dad actually worked with to open it up in 1958. So in 1958, the summer solstice, coincidentally, we opened it up. And it was called the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire at the time. And you can see why in the photographs. There's a lot of, you know, stonework in that site. It's pretty amazing with the big slabs and everything, roof slabs. And so in that winter, they decided to change the name to Mystery Hill Caves. And that name was the name we had until 63. In 1963, almost 60 years ago, they decided that the word caves confused people, thinking they were natural caves. And these are man-made structures. So that name stayed with us until 1982. And 40 years ago this year, they changed the name to America's Stonehenge. And it's because of the function of the site is astronomically aligned with the sun, moon, and stars. Yeah. It's not to the form. It doesn't look like Stonehenge. There is a circle of stones, but it's not the same structure as Stonehenge, but it does serve the same purpose. In fact, our site covers about almost 110 acres, actually. So it's a pretty big area. The whole hill has walls. It has standing stones. It has structures. And even walls we called serpentine walls we've been finding in the last 6 years. So the whole hilltop has features on it. And the hill never had a name until I think around 1968, the USGS decided to give it an official name. Some people called it Paddy's Hill. There were various names for it. It became officially Mystery Hill in 68, from what I can tell. And that's the name on the topographical maps today. So the hill does have a name, and it's because of the name of the business at one time. And so the word Mystery Hill is still around, you know, and some people like the old name better than the new name. But the astronomical work didn't begin actually until 1965, you know. So that work is almost 60 years old, too. And you can see a map there you're looking at. It's got some of the lines that radiate from the center of near the center of the site on the north side of it, actually. And we have today, we believe, about 57 alignments with the sun, moon, and stars. The solstices, equinoxes, cross-quarter days. We have the lunar cycle, which takes 18 and a half year. We have what we believe are 23 star alignments plus two north, which is with Polaris today. And 4,000 years ago, the Earth's axis was pointing towards Thubian. And Thubian is a star. Draco of a constellation, which some people feel looks like a serpent or a dragon. Yeah. And so there's a sophistication to the site, the walls, in the orientation of the structures. The main site, most of the structures are orientated true north, south, east, and west. One exception is the structure called the V-head. It faces the winter solstice sunset direction, kind of in the southwest. And that structure looks to me like some of the wedge tombs I've seen in Ireland. And the wedge tombs in Ireland always face southwest. So the size, shape, and orientation. You can see a picture of what we call the table, a sacrificial table. It's about a 9,000-pound stone. It has a large groove on it with four legs. And just to the left of that, if your viewers are seeing that same image, is where the oracle chamber is. It's kind of hiding in that hill behind it. And the left side of the table is actually into the chamber, kind of supporting it too, plus the four legs underneath the table. And the oracle chamber is kind of hidden, and it has a tube that comes out underneath the table, and the tube is 6 feet long. It runs east and west. It's about a foot by a foot in its size, and again, it's horizontal and runs 6 feet, comes out underneath the table on the side closest to what we're looking at. I don't think it's in a shadow, I think. I don't know if you can see it, but if a voice is spoken through that, the voice comes out underneath the table, and if you're standing photographer was, they're on top of what we call a ramp, and you're looking down at this table, which we think could be a ceremonial table again, you know,
sure,
and watching some sort of a celebration going on the table. Some people suggest that the table is a sacrificial table. We don't know for sure. We don't have the evidence. Some people say it's a birthing table, you know. And there is a carving in a town of Massachusetts in Shutesbury. It's 75 miles southwest of our property. And it has stone chambers there. It's on a hill. And when an owner overturned a stone back around 1950, the stone was actually a carving. It was an anaglyph, a raised carving. And the carving looks like a person with the legs spread. And around the person is a carving of what looks like the shape of the table, the bell shape that you can see there. And the person spread out on it, on their back apparently, with something around the neck on this carving. And by the front left foot on our table is where the runnel is. And below the runnel is a cutout in the bedrock where either a fluid of some kind could actually drip off the table after going through the groove. And going into that groove, I don't know if in that picture there's some white paint outlining a little cutout in the bedrock, but you could put a bowl in there. And that almost looks like a bowl that they're indicating by the left foot. So it's really interesting. The shape of that image around looks like the table shape of the bell, the person laying on their back, and then by the front left. You know, maybe just coincidental, but it looks like somebody came up and had like a Polaroid, you know, moment. They took this image, they took it back, and they carved this table, this anaglyph, you know. And again, there are other stone structures at that particular site. And in the background of that image there is one of the standing monoliths. We have a lot of those on top of the hill. Multi-ton stones stood up on their end that were quarried, just like the table was quarried off the bedrock. And on the right side of the picture, a little hard to see, is actually, it looks like a little chamber. You can see where it's a little dark space with a roof slab on top. Below that is another chamber. And that chamber sits on top of it, almost like a two-story building, if you would. You can't quite see the bottom. You can't see the underneath part of it. It's kind of hiding. If you went down by the table and continued past the table into the area beyond it, you look back, you see the two-story building standing right in front of you. We call it the double solar. So this is kind of near the main part of the site. And where the photographer is on a ramp. And just behind them is the astronomical center of the site, where all those lines came together in one of your previous pictures you had up there. And that's where two cairns once stood. Yeah, there were two cairns that used to stand there marking the two centers. If you look hard enough, you can see where everything comes together near the center, but it's actually two points that all the lines come to. And that's where the cairns were until about 1938. And Goodwin had Malcolm Pearson, who was a professional photographer, photograph everything, including those two cairns, which are piles of rocks. Goodwin thought they were beehive chambers because the outside were kind of like a beehive chamber you might see in Ireland. Once he got into them a little bit, he found they were solid stone structures. He didn't know what their function was. And they would be in this photograph off to the left. I think the wooden platform's in the background, perhaps, in that picture. It's a little bit hard for me to see that.
Little gazebo.
The gazebo, right below it. Yeah, we built a gazebo about almost, I think 1974 we started that. So almost 50 years ago we built that. I remember helping on that, seems like yesterday. But Goodwin, unfortunately, thought they were just discarded stones. So what he did is he was rebuilding part of the ramp because it had some damage done to it. So we have photographs of his crew with a hand winch with a tripod lifting up the rocks from those two stone cairns, basically dismantling them. And it wasn't until 40 years later we discovered that they were the astronomical center of the site. And those were the markers, which unfortunately he took apart. Yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, his intentions were very good. He wasn't destructive. He was just trying to in those days, a lot of rebuilding, you know. We had I did a lecture about the site and how it's what it looked like before Goodwin and after. And it has been altered slightly. I mean, the stones have been put back on the structures. But we did it, and we included places like Chaco Canyon. We did a number of other different sites around the world, including some megalith sites over in Europe where restoration took place. And some of the sites aren't even recognizable, you know, because of the changes, you know, where people in the last century or so started rebuilding these chambers. And today, most of it's preventative maintenance and maintenance, but not rebuilding. That seems to be the theme. We went to Chaco Canyon 3 years ago, a Mesa Verde Hoven Week, Canyon of the Ancients, and a few other sites. We went to Florida this year, too, to Crystal River Mounds and the Turtle Mound near Cape Kennedy. Yeah. And the theme seems to be today not to rebuild unless it's going to prevent the structure from falling in, you know.
Yeah.
But you just keep them up, preventative maintenance, like I mentioned, but not so much like rebuilding, you know. That's the thing. They don't do as much now. And in the Goodwin's time, they did. They did a lot of rebuilding. But we have the photographs before, and we have the photographs during, because Malcolm, again, was a professional photographer. He just started clicking his camera away and took photographs all the way up to basically before he died, he visited us. So for many, many decades, he came up and photographed it. But before Goodwin's work, he photographed it. So we know what the changes are with Goodwin. He usually took a rock within 3 feet of a wall and have his crew put it back on top of the wall kind of thing, and then clean up the debris, sift it, look for artifacts. But the site still kind of looks like the site did when he came up there. It had a lot more brush on it and a lot of trees, but the walls and everything are in their place pretty much, you know, and the table hasn't been moved or anything like that. It's where the table, when he first photographs it, is buried to the bottom. They thought it was sitting on the ground. That's one of the 14 windows you're showing there. There's a double window, I think. You can see how the holes go through it. And that's something we've discovered in the last 6 years. This is one of the first ones I found.
Huh.
It actually has a stone shutter that goes into it. And that one there is also a similar one, but inside of it, the stones are laid horizontally as shutters. And the day they were up here filming for the History Channel, we were finished up with the cameraman. He was doing B-roll, and as we walked back towards the visitor center, our assistant archaeologist, his name is Pete, was walking, the three of us were walking the cameraman down, and Pete looks over and he goes, "Hey, is that another one of those windows?" And I said, "I don't know." We went over and looked at it, and all those little stones inside are loose, like Venetian blinds inside of it. So while the cameraman had put all his stuff away, unfortunately, we could have actually filmed that live as we discovered it. That's an illumination. That's one of our astronomical events.
Yeah.
And you can see how that's a watch house. So the sunlight goes in and illuminates that stone and frames it. And about after 30 minutes, it turns into, it looks like a hand. It morphs into like a hand shape with an index finger pointing back at the quartzite stone, you know. And that's new to 2020.
And those illuminations happen because of the windows, correct?
Well, the windows, that's still a mystery. We don't know if they're astronomically aligned.
Oh, okay.
That illumination is because of the shape of the doorway of the watch house. And when that light goes in there, there's shadow and light. And that was found by a friend of mine from Texas. Her name is Haley. She had a Sunseeker. She had just got out of college. She took archaeology. She dug in Mexico. She also took astronomy and astrophysics. And she was just in Scotland living. She's done stuff all over the world, ancient sites and everything. And she's done some tours and stuff. But she said with a Sunseeker in the spring of 2019, she goes, if you can see the sunlight come through here, because we had a forestry project planned and it hadn't been started yet. She goes, if you get trees cleared out of here, she goes, come here in the morning on the equinox, you got to see the sunlight come down and strike this quartzite stone at the back of this chamber. And we've been talking about that quartzite stone for decades. Hans Holzer actually wrote a book in 1992, long before Columbus. And Barbara Hand Cloud did the foreword. And in that foreword, she talks about that quartzite stone as being important. That was 30 years ago. But after Haley, about a year later, we had the forest project was already begun. And they had removed trees to our neighbors, opening that up up to the neighbor's border. And it allowed the sunlight to come into that chamber for the first time that we've ever seen, you know, in our lives. And when we did on the equinox of 2020, we had a nice group of people there. And we watched as the sunlight went in. We thought it was just going to illuminate the stone. And it's brighter than the other stones. Very, very white color, kind of quartzite.
Yeah.
Sunlight struck it. We realized that it actually, about 8 o'clock in the morning, that it actually framed the stone on the top and the left side of it because of the shape of the doorway. And it stayed like that for several minutes. And then as the sun's rising, the shadow starts changing, of course, and it morphs into what looks like a hand with an index finger pointing back at that quartzite. Our thought is that might represent the sun, the rays, the fertilization of an egg, perhaps. Because I've been to Newgrange in Ireland on the winter solstice. The sunlight goes in that 65-foot, you know, tunnel, and at the back it's cruciform shape, and it illuminates the back wall. And some people suggest, again, the sun, the rays, the fertilization going into this womb-like into the back. There's some stone basins back there they might have put offerings on. And today they have a lottery. We were there about 40 years ago at Newgrange. But Chaco Canyon, on the same morning that our quartzite stone's illuminating on the equinox, they have a serpent carving, and the sunlight strikes that and splits the serpent petroglyph right in half. And there are two caves in Colorado called Pathfinder and Crack Creek that are caves, but they've been modified somewhat. In the back wall, there's these serpent carvings again. And that same day, again, those are being split by the sun's rays in the shadow. Mojave North is another one in California. And if you go down to Chichen Itza in Mexico, that morning, Kukulcan's going down the 91 staircase. And I've been there too. We were in the 80s. I didn't get to see that event. So we have a serpent thing because that watch house would leave us a head of a 2,550-foot serpent. And the LIDAR imaging I might have sent you, there's an S-shaped serpent there. The head's on the very right. The body goes to the right. And in the far, far distance, my camera's very small, but it goes to the left again, like a big S shape, 140 feet, and ends with a boulder.
Absolutely. And, you know, even the structures, I know I remember in previous conversations I'd mentioned had it been explored the fact, are those kind of like peep sight chambers, you know, where for astronomical observation you can back yourself up and excuse the exterior light that may exist from the moon or something like that.
That's the thought of too. Yeah, that's something we're going to have to do something more with. We're still looking at the possibility of looking from the inside of the chamber out. There is a structure in Massachusetts called the Upton Chamber. And that chamber, actually, 100 years ago, Malcolm Pearson, again, his family, bought the property at Upton, and the man that sold it said, young man, there's a cellar out back. And it was not a cellar hole like you think of. It was looks more like a beehive chamber or a passage chamber. And it looks like an igloo, if you really will. You know, the entrance looks like an igloo, and it goes in, and it's a very large corbelled structure. And they say that chamber, if you fit into the – and I've been there a couple of times, most recently, just 2 years ago. And you get into the back wall of it, and you look through the entrance, and you're looking at the Pleiades. And there's the Upton Chamber right there. Yes, that's it. And it's an amazing structure. That's – on the left is looking into it, of course, inside looking out. There's trees and forest in the way, but they calculated if the trees weren't in the way right now, you'd be looking at the Pleiades. Mm. And on the hill – you're looking at in the distance is called Pratt Hill, and it has some stonework on top that's man-made that they say aligns with that entrance also. So maybe you're looking at the Pleiades in the I think it's a Carn or whatever. So there is this inside looking out kind of thing at that particular chamber. And by the way, you can visit the Upton Chamber. It's in a park today, and it's basically in Malcolm Pearson's family's backyard. I think the family sold that home in 1970. So for a while, Goodwin owned America Stonehenge, and his family owned the Upton Chamber.
Interesting. Did he have an interest in such things, or was it just mere coincidence the fact that he owned both locations? Because that's a pretty extreme coincidence,
right? Yeah,
you know. You know, I ended up buying two haunted houses in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and why did you? How did you do that? Right. Well, I think what happened 100 years ago when Malcolm saw that, I think it just changed his whole life. That chamber in his backyard, and what his interest, and it was an interest that stayed with him for the rest of his life. I think it's a story how it actually goes. But Goodwin, I guess, was told about some of the structures by his friend out in Seattle. And this gentleman, I'm trying to think, he had a Scandinavian name. He was a big on runestones. Olaf Strandwell is his name. He's kind of known in the circles. I guess one of the gripes is everything he saw was Viking runestones, even if they weren't, you know. But it's not a guy. He was an explorer, researcher. He had a lot of pluses, but he also has, like everybody, has some negatives, I guess. But he told Goodwin, and Goodwin was living in Seattle for a while, and then he was living in San Francisco. He's involved with insurance. And he lived in Columbus, Ohio for 15 years. And on his days off in Columbus, he would go out and map some of the mounds in Ohio for the highway department. That was over 100 years ago. And then he moved back to Hartford, Connecticut, his home. He was a first cousin of J.P. Morgan, by the way. You know, and the Morgans and the Goodwins were the same family. And but Morgan died in 13, so he never heard of this site or his interest in these ancient ruins, I guess. And Goodwin died in 1950. But so Strandwell, I think, got Malcolm in touch with Goodwin or vice versa because of his chamber and his family's property. And Goodwin got really interested in that. And he's thinking Viking, you know. Goodwin was really into the Viking. So he eventually made arrangements to meet Malcolm, come up from Hartford to Upton. And also Malcolm was already familiar with the Acton, Massachusetts structure, which is still there today. and the Hoppington structure. And Hoppington is where they start the Boston Marathon from, to give people a little idea of that area. So Goodwin came up from Hartford, probably, I think it was 36. He saw the Akron Chamber, the Hoppington Chamber, the Upton Chamber, and then Malcolm goes, I'm going to take you to North Salem, New Hampshire, and show you this, what some people call the Great Stone Village or whatever. And so Goodwin made arrangements to come up. I guess it came up a different day. And we have Goodwin's first thoughts. We have it on our in our visitor center. We have a big banner, and we have his first impressions. It's very poetic. But Goodwin, basically, like my dad and many others, were just blown away by the site. So that's how Malcolm kind of got in with Goodwin and in our site. And then Goodwin bought the site in 37. And when he passed away in 1950, he willed the site to Malcolm Pearson. So that's how the Pearson family kind of ended up with this. Just buying a house. And there's a structure. This, it got his interest. And then the second thing is because of Malcolm's interest. So the family actually had the Hill and the Upton Chamber at the same time, you know, during the season.
Interesting.
Now,
Here on Atlas Obscura, let me read this real quick. The Upton Stone Chamber isn't the only of its kind. It's one of over 300 known mysterious stone chambers found across New England. Most archaeologists consider these chambers to be root cellars built by early settlers, but others argue they're ruins of Native American structures. Skipping ahead, according to a 2015 USGS survey, analysis of the chamber estimates its age to being built between 1350 and 1625. Now, in our previous conversations with you, it should be heavily noted that when settlers of your area, of the Salem area in New Hampshire, came upon your location, they asked the Native Americans. This is a pretty cool place. That's pretty neat that y'all built that. And the Native American response was, we didn't build, I don't know who built that. But we didn't build that. That was here when we got here.
That same thing has happened, I think, a number of times, you know, these settlers asking these questions. But the easy answer is that, yes, there are root cellars, but I think the percentage
dismissive answer.
I think it is. It's an easy answer, a dismissive answer, and then they don't have to deal with it. Basically, in the policies, they have a title and a degree or whatever, and so they must know it all. So these structures are probably all that colonial or post-colonial without the person actually going out there and investigating them, studying them, collecting data. You know,
people always build root cellars A in complexes and B where they don't live.
Right, right.
Those are two common things about root cellars, Dennis. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, actually, I worked at a farm in 69, and they had a one made out of concrete. They had just built in 68, you know, a root cellar, you know. So we used to put the produce in there at night. But some gentleman actually tried one of these stone structures just last winter, and he put some potatoes and some other things, I guess, inside. He listed what he put in there, and they spoiled.
I was going to say, they got destroyed.
They don't have they're supposed to have ventilation in a root cellar. I think 75% of these structures do not have ventilation. The entrances are usually facing a solstice, equinox, or another astronomical event, like a cross quarter day, or maybe like the Upton Chamber towards the Pleiades, maybe the equinox. And the floor is usually supposed to have something on them insulating them from the cold, you know. These structures are sitting on bedrock, and you'll have your vegetables freezing there. The doorways of these structures, some you can actually walk in very easily. Others, like the watch house, you have to basically crawl into it. How you bring in your wheelbarrow or anything and walk in, you'll hit your head every time you go into the watch house. You can't really be carrying anything. And a gentleman just videotaped it that day, and actually, he's a kind of a researcher, and he's into minerals and gems. He's been coming up for years, but his main thing is gems and minerals and black ultraviolet lights and everything. He does things like, but as he's videotaping going into the watch house, he actually rolled into it. He fell over with his camera rolling, you know, on the video, and that's how hard it is to get into some of these structures.
Even the one that I have up right now. Granted, I'm a large individual. I run about 6'1". But even for an average height person, this would be a decent stoop over to get inside of.
Right. Why did they do it? Why would you ever build it like
this? This isn't a comfortable place to go in and work or get in and out of or anything like that. Now, for you to sit inside of it for an extended period, different story.
But, you know, the dry stone construction, and so they're not really insulated against, yeah, also protected against moisture coming into the walls or anything like that, you know. They have stone roofs, too, which is another thing. What they don't look at is the big rock slabs are actually shaped using, at our site, percussion flaking. And that's been documented by Dr. David Stewart Smith, who passed away in 2016. And he was working under Dr. Gary Hume, our state archaeologist in New Hampshire. And Dr. Gary Hume was a lithic specialist. He knew how stone tools were actually created, you know, using percussion flaking, pressure flaking, the napping. And when he, 40 years ago, worked with Dave on one of the big slabs that was found in situ in its quarry site, a woman named Mary actually sat on it in 1982 having her lunch. She went up in the woods by herself and had a lunch, and staff had already been informed by David Stewart Smith to look for big stones that might be propped up artificially, you know, if you can see that, and also the edge of it may be serrated by somebody striking it with a hammer. It'll look like the edge of an arrow, an arrowhead, the little dimpling on it, you know. And so as she's sitting there, she starts to notice that, you know, having her lunch, and she realized the stone was also up in the air. So she looked, I guess she could tell the stone had been propped up. She showed it to Dave, and the next year, he was very excited, of course. The next year, he excavated and found all the little stones falling where somebody had been dressing the stone dressing the stone by percussion flaking, actually shaping it.
Yeah, yeah.
Striking it. All the little flakes will come off. They'll fall onto the what's below it, whether the earth or the bedrock. There is bedrock below it, but the earth. And when he excavated in 83 with Dr. Gary Hume, they found all those little flakes. Gary Hume said, it's unmistakable that they were shaping this similar to an arrowhead, but a multi-ton arrowhead. It's the same Stone Age technology being used. And we found 34 of those stones since that time in 40 years, a lot in the last few years. Some of these are the size of like a kitchen table, 4 or 5 feet across. Some of them are 8 or 9 feet across, you know, by four, weighing multiple tons. And they're all elevated or raised up with like a field stone, like a rounded field stone generally, or sometimes a little stone block. And then the edge of them, if you look at them, you can see where they were hammering on it to shape it. And then the mystery became, why were they working all these stones all over the hill? Some of them are 1,000 feet from what we call the main site, which you're looking at in that photograph. Why were they doing this, still making all these big slabs? And then what happened? I thought is they had a work in progress. This site was going to continue to be built. And then something drove these people away from this project. And then the question is why, you know? Even as you're looking at right there, has actually been shaped. It was part of the bedrock, and it's the winter solstice sunset. They dressed that stone to look like theirs literally looks like a gigantic arrowhead, you know?
Yeah.
And it goes to the ground a couple feet, too. And I think that picture was taken last year. Maybe that one's from last year. I took that one. But that's how our monoliths look. And we had a comment from one of the archaeologists in the state in a Discovery magazine, and it was just put out again recently by an author that was up, I think, on the solstice. She never talked to us. I wish she had. If she was there that day, I don't know who it was, but this just came up. It was in the news, and they used this 1998 Discovery magazine with one of our archaeologists. And he said, well, it's a coincidence with these astronomical alignments. You have so many rocks up there, you can make any alignment you want. And that's kind of true. But we're not looking at any rock. We're looking at stones that are shaped like that one right there stood up. It's very obvious that stone was stood up for a purpose. It's not just one of the regular rocks in the wall, if you know what I mean. It's a monolith, and that's how the monoliths look. So we're not looking at any little rock, you know, in the stone wall.
Yeah.
And these things are actually intentional. And I don't know how somebody can just blow it off like that.
But yeah. Well, especially whenever they all converge on one spot. You know, even if you look at the overhead map of the place, the overhead outlay of the walls, things like that, it seems to be, it is not a random association of things. It seems to be built as though some kind of complex, and especially, you know, one of the things that spurred your name and conversation with Jared Murphy was this table and the construction of it. And like you were saying, the fact that there is a chamber, that there is a tunnel underneath where the voice echoes through, what it reminded me of was temples in ancient Greece.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Temple of Poseidon, Temple of Zeus, things like that, where the high priest would go underneath the altar, and yeah, you would have a ceremony, something like that, even an initiation into higher ranks of the priesthood, and hear the god's voice speak. Because there was a priest underneath you and a tube going up underneath the altar that you were standing on. So that was one of the things that just kind of sparked my mind. And whenever you're talking about hundreds of chambers like this across a state.
Right.
I don't think that's coincidental.
No.
To have hundreds of chambers of similar construction.
You mentioned 300, I think, Chris, you know, and that's New England. I think the number now from Quebec to Virginia is about 800 sites.
Wow.
And a site could be our site with 106 acres. Windham, New Hampshire has a chamber, and that's a site too. So it could be one chamber. It could be multiple chambers. North Stonington, Connecticut, we might have talked about that. We found that out about that site from 2016.
Even just the forethought of this construction, that's not a root cellar.
Right. It doesn't look I'm in Vermont, you know, for 3 years of my first airline job up in North Clarendon, right by the Rutland Airport. And I used to ride my 10-speed when I wasn't flying around the area too. And I was doing some instruction too. So we've been flying kind of low over some of the farms and looking at them going like they have a lot of fences up there. Some of it's walls, but like it doesn't look like our wall patterns or fence pattern at our site. In the picture you showed with the walls, they turn, they twist, they bend. Farmers' walls, with some exceptions, are fairly linear. You know, they run kind of straight. There are boundaries, field clearings, and fences. Sometimes all three. They serve all three purposes. In some cases, you can see that one there. Just big turn to the left, a big turn to the right, and then back to the left again. Unless it was a drunk farmer or a professional wall builder.
Yeah.
But it only goes 140 feet. It doesn't do anything. And it is sitting on bedrock. Every wall up there is sitting on bedrock, and the soil has accumulated next to them. And we have what we think today is 14 serpent walls. And that's probably the only S-shaped one we found so far.
Wow.
Some are linear, some are rectilinear, some are look like they're biting their tails. We have three of those. If they are, if that's what they're doing, that could be an Ouroboros, the circle of life, you know, eternity.
Absolutely. And
possibly, you know.
And once again, would ring to the fact that what we're looking at here with the table and the chamber and the echoic tunnel, things like that, is possibly some sort of initiation site, possibly some sort of site of esoteric knowledge.
That's what we're thinking. And they were teaching there maybe too, possibly.
Yeah. Which would highly explain all of the astronomic alignments, everything else. Once again, it's not that Native Americans as a whole don't build structure, like permanent structure. But most of that exists west of the Mississippi, down south on the East Coast, that kind of stuff. Most of the Native American tribes in the area up there are nomadic tribes. They move with the weather. To understand the area, to understand the weather, even if it was somewhere to stop and get your bearings as a hunter-gatherer. You know, here's a universal site. Long as you make it to here by this point in the year, you can follow this and make sure you're in the right spot for your travel further on. But that would be an extreme form of communication across a culture. You know, it sounds far-fetched to say an initiation site, to say something like that. But when you start looking at everything, especially the echoic chamber, That's the one that just brings it home to me as this is something other.
When you're standing there, Chris, in the middle of the site, and that's a pretty good picture right there you have. You know, it doesn't have, to me, it doesn't not look like a shoe shop. The Paddies are shoemakers, five generations. It doesn't look like a farm. It doesn't look like a cider mill. And some people suggest that that table was a lye stone for making soap. Either a soap-making table or a cider-making, you know, a cider press. You can't get a horse and a wagon in there. There's no way you can get in there. It's got that big wall that the gentleman or whoever, the woman or whoever's taking this picture is standing on. And you have a table. I have three different ATVs, including a big red, the smallest one. I can't get that in there to get the leaves out every year. I have to go in there, rake the leaves, and hand carry them to the car. And I have my friend from Texas, the one I mentioned earlier, she was a rodeo star. I said, could you ever get your horse in here, you know, and get a wagon? She says, no way. You can't even without the wagon, you know, try to get the horse in. So why would you build this thing like this as a cider mill?
Or even a meat processing table.
It's so inaccessible, you know.
Exactly.
And why are all the standing stones behind, actually to the left of the picture, out of the frame is a similar monolith stood up. The one in the foreground, you can see, there's almost a twin. It's a little slightly different, a little thinner shape, almost like some people suggest that the thinner shape represents the male and the wider shape suggests the female with the wider hips. And the other one could be phallic. I've been to Europe several times into Stonehenge and Avebury, and they have the West Kennet Avenue. And they have West Kennet Avenue. Part of it's missing today, but it looks like a processional path. We have two of those at our site. They're more like wall processional paths. But there, they say the stones that are tallest are the male, and the ones that are a little wider are the female. So you have like male and female on both sides as you're going down this avenue. You know, dualism, fertility, you know, male, female, maybe goddesses or gods kind of thing. That's what some people suggest. We don't know what the original builders thought. But, yeah, you can't get into that area or the oracle chamber very easily. You certainly couldn't take a wheelbarrow in there, never mind a horse with a wagon, bring in your apples.
Yeah, to bring all your roots for storage.
Exactly, yeah. And the oracle chamber is long and skinny. It looks like the letter Y if you would take the roof off of it and look straight down at it. It's a lot of work, very little space that it yields. You know, square footage, if you will. It has five closets inside that chamber. It has what looks like an 8-foot bed in the wall with a window looking into the chamber. And then above that's the oracle tube that you've been mentioning, you know. And when Goodwin came, his crew found that tube, as well as some of the underground drains, these are man-made underground drains, had blocks of stone blocking them up. And they didn't even know the oracle tube was there until one of the gentlemen moved the rock, pulled it out of the wall because it was loose, and he sees a whole 6-foot tunnel. He went to the other side, pulled out the rock, and unfortunately those two stone plugs are missing today, but they were actually like they blocked up the tube to conceal it when it wasn't in use, perhaps. Kind of like the Wizard of Oz thing, you know, you go in there and you talk, the voice comes out, and people hear your voice thinking you're a spirit. We've been to Malta, too, and in Malta there was holes in the walls.
Yep.
And I asked the guy, what are those for? He goes, those are oracles. This is where oracles speak. And the voice would come through. I said, we have something to that in New Hampshire, you know. And you mentioned in Greece. I've been to Delphi.
Yeah.
And they had the oracle there, too. I hadn't been to the other two you mentioned, but we were in Delphi, too. The site looks ceremonial to me. Those windows are amazing. Those windows are in the stone walls. There's 14 of those, we think, today, and 14 servants. They are in other sites, including North Stonington and other places, too, both serpent walls. Mark Eddy just sent me another article. It was a report of a serpent wall in West Virginia. They're in Kentucky, and one in Kentucky has a very, very wide mouth. The wall was built out kind of like a Y shape, and then a body goes to the main body, and then the body kind of goes off in the distance. They're being found all the way out to Weed, California, Alabama. They call them rattlesnake walls.
Yep.
But they're also in the Hudson Valley. The Hudson Valley has about 500 different structures, and some of the structures are chambers. Some are standing stones, some are cairns, but some are serpentine walls and only being recognized in the last couple of years. And we didn't know anything about this in 2015, about serpent walls. So,
this was a recent find for you guys. And once again, you've been on property just about your whole life.
Exactly. I was about a year and a half old. Yeah. So we never saw him. My dad used to go out.
Wow.
One of the pictures that you showed of the astronomical alignments, and then you showed one without the alignments but the walls. That's about you're showing there approximately. Yeah, that one there. That's about just about 15 acres of the 106. So you don't see all. I don't have an image of all the walls that are all over the hilltop. Yeah. That's 15 acres, and then a few serpent walls in that. And that actually, that perimeter is one of the biggest serpent walls. It starts at the watch house, 2,550 feet long. Outside of what you're seeing there, there are more serpent walls. There are quarry sites, and there are windows in some of the stone walls all over the next roughly 90 acres, if you will, that you don't even see. So we're showing you 15 acres. What we need to do now is get a nice map showing you the walls all over the property. I can give you a similar image with that, but everything, not just the 15 acres you're looking at. So that's not the entirety of the property you're looking at there.
I mean, it's just a small slice. I believe that's what you had done just prior to the first time we had you on.
That's what we LIDAR. 15 acres, we have the LIDAR. Yeah. And you can see down to a center. And we're going to be doing, we have a hard drive on that. 600 hours of processing. And that LIDAR is amazing. It shows the serpent walls. It shows, like, a features down to about the size. A penny shows up, and even a centimeter is a little bit smaller than that, but a centimeter. You can see down to that. So all these different features talking about with the LIDAR are on the LIDAR in the 15 acres. The other 90 acres, we haven't done LIDAR on, you know.
That is incredible.
So it's a lot of data we have now, you know, and ground penetration radar, too. We've done several thousand square feet. And the one that's doing that's going to come back and do all our 12 underground drains. Some of the drains run 75 feet underground, and they've never been excavated. Not all of them. A couple of them have the Oracle chamber, and there was some evidence that came out, like they had hammer stones and some tools that had got washed into the drains, apparently, or they were left behind when they built these drains. But she's going to map those, and what she has mapped already is the Oracle chamber roof, where we got optically stimulated luminescence cores that we tested. And she's going to blend that imaging with the LIDAR for 3D above and below. She's friends with the LIDAR gentleman, and he's been doing LIDAR at some other sites. He lives in Connecticut. He's doing sites from our site all the way down to Pennsylvania. And so he's collecting data using LIDAR, and she's been doing some of the ground penetration radar. And together, to put both images together would be very good, because you sit on your computer and really analyze these pictures and images for pictures, artifacts, or whatever, you know?
Yeah, that is an incredible opportunity for you guys. That's fantastic, because once again, I just posted an article to our group the other day about an entire new complex that was found in Guatemala.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Whole new complex found because of LIDAR, because of people using LIDAR and drones and going over spots.
That's amazing. Yeah. And no one knew what was there. It was all forgotten about.
Yeah.
Until LIDAR showed it. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially being able to use ground penetrating radar, things like that in some of the areas to find, once again, maybe chambers that have collapsed that you haven't been able to see, what have you.
That's because we do have one that was during the 48 hurricane. It's near the lower well. 1988, we took the remains of the pine stump off of it, and we laid it out in meter squares. And that was in 88. In 89, we were going to go and actually start excavating, because a manager in 1958, he was there for a couple of years. His daughter, 10 years prior to that, used to play in the chamber. And all you see today is a flat spot, because the 38 hurricane, very famous, but there was one about 10 years later. The whole tree came down, it came across the double wall path, and it collapsed the whole structure. We did put ground penetration radar on it in the 1990s. We had some equipment from that time, because he used to make it right down the street, geophysical survey systems. And we had him put the radar on top, and they said, well, about several feet down, you have what looks like a flat floor. So that really got our interest. Unfortunately, in 89, we ended up on a dig in front of the North Stone, the stone that aligns with Polaris today in Thuban. The stone was starting to slowly settle. It looked like it eventually would fall over. So we brought in the New Hampshire Archaeological Society's president, and she stayed with us for the next 32 years, actually. When she came, she never left us.
I don't know that I would be able to either, Dennis.
Yeah, which was good, you know, because she was a mainstream, and her things are pottery and points and colonial stuff, you know, not stone ruins, you know. And so, but it grabbed her, you know. And she's still alive. She's in Florida at the moment. She visited us about 2 months ago. She's in her 80s, so she really can't do the work. She's looking for a replacement, which is very difficult to find somebody that looks at these ruins as artifact. But she worked on a North Stone and they found a fire pit. And that was a 3-year project. My son was born in 89. And by the time they finished, he was 2 years old in 1990. Wow. So they went 89, 90, 91. And they worked on that North Stone and they found the fire pit. And that dated to 1300 years old. And the important thing is that the stone was there first. It was an earlier feature somebody had put in. It could have been thousands of years ago. Somebody about 700 AD came along and built a fire up against the base of it, and they left the charcoal. And so when they excavated down, they found the layers of stratigraphy, all the different color bands undisturbed next to the stone, and there's the fire pit. And they sent the charcoal out, had it dated. So we never got back to that 1988, that collapsed structure. And I do want to put radar's a little better today than it was in the 90s, the last time we did it. So yeah. I like her, put it on top, run around. She's a geophysicist too, so she has a degree in that. But have her run over it. Have her give her analysis of it. What do you think you're looking at here? Should we excavate this? You know, because our manager's daughter used to play inside of what she said was a chamber. And when you look at it today, it's a big kind of a depression there, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't see the chamber. But they swear, you know, this was a structure there until 1948. So we might get back to that, you know?
Well, that's precisely. And that's why somebody of that ilk is literally spent a lifetime helping you research the place, because there's more than a lifetime of work to be done to even to catalog what's there, to use new means to re-explore. You know, that is one of the things that we talk about regularly, whether it's cryptozoology, ufology, what have you. Our scientific means now are different than they were 5 years ago. Yeah. So to be able to re-examine evidence with new technology can provide whole new worlds of data.
Trained in it, you know, and they know what they're doing. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you guys looking at next? I know Solstice just happened. So how can people contact you for tours? What are you looking at getting going next for America's Stonehenge, Dennis?
We have different projects we'd like to do up there. One of them, I just mentioned getting that ground penetration radar back. She was going to come in October. Something happened, and I think she'll have to put it off to spring when everything, you know, snow goes away and it thaws out again. We also have three bones that were found. I might have mentioned those to you on the main site back in 1930s by Mr. Goodwin. And in 1968, they were brought to the Smithsonian, and a Dr. Lucy Huygen actually looked at them. And she was a physical anthropologist, and she said, well, these are human bones. They have markings on them. We get the report on this, by the way.
Huh.
She said, there are three bones, you know, and she said they were marked, and while the person was alive, these scratch marks or whatever they are on the bones happened, so the person was living. But she said the thing is that they're much denser material than she would normally think for a human bone. That kind of troubled her. In the end, and the last thing she says was that my feeling is that these are human. While they were out of the ground in 68 for 30 years, so you couldn't radiocarbon date it. They were contaminated by being exposed to the elements, if you would, you know?
Sure.
So I've been talking to a friend of mine from California. I talked to him 2 days ago, and he's going to be out here again. He's done the Paracas skulls down in South America with the DNA, and he has in Toronto. And he says, maybe we should look at DNA. And so I don't know what limitations are. These bones have been exposed to the elements for 80-something years. Maybe that doesn't matter. But I would be very, very happy if we could look into having this done. I don't know how much of the bone they have to take, you know, and destroy for the DNA. Maybe it's just a small amount.
I don't think it's a whole lot. I think it's literally the equivalent of, like, let's take a jeweler's drill and get past the surface.
That would be interesting, and we could do that. We would do they've been sitting in our museum on display for decades, and I finally went through all these, my dad's files. I'm looking at the photographs, a newspaper article that came out in 68 about, you know, the report from the Smithsonian, and there's a picture of these bones, and I went back over to our display cabinet, because most of everything has an identification on it. These bones are just kind of sitting there, and I went, there they are. They're right there in front of me.
Wow.
And I was just totally shocked. I mean, we tried to you know as much as we can about the site and all the different things that have happened over the years. But, you know,
while somebody was alive.
Yeah, I know. It's that, to me, I think would be one of the things. And so we're going to talk about that. He's going to be coming out here and he wants to take a sample off the Oracle chamber to have it analyzed. And he's going to tell me a little bit more what he wants to accomplish for that. But the DNA on these bones, I think, would be really exciting.
You know, maybe even doing some deep DNA analysis on the grooves of the table, things like that, to see if anything can be lifted.
That's a great point. There is a thing called protein analysis, and you can take, an arrowhead or anything that might have gone into an animal or human, and if any of the blood gets inside of a microfissure, they can extract that. So I did talk to somebody about that recently, and our archaeologist, one of her New Hampshire archaeological assistants, she was at our site a few years ago, and I mentioned it to her, and she goes, well, the problem is the table's been exposed to the elements, the top surface, for years, so you know, highly unlikely it worked, but she goes, you never know. Maybe you might be able to extract something from a groove.
Yeah.
And that might tell you whether it's human or animal. And then if it's animal, what type of animal, you know?
Yeah.
It's a possibility, you know, it's still there, you know, maybe science.
I think to not explore it would be the real disservice, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And we can, you know,
that once again is the reason why you had a New Hampshire archaeologist just suddenly pivot on point and and hop in your pocket, because it's just a fascinating realm of study to get into and to think about. There is something that could literally be discovered annually.
I think so, yeah. And this, you know, at one time we were criticized because, well, this site was an ancient site. How come there's not other sites? And back in Goodwin's time,
there's 300 of them just in the state of New Hampshire. What are you talking about?
Basically, New England, then you get about 800 from Quebec to Virginia. So, and they're stone structures, and there's a very strong resemblance between the structures, you know, and we're looking at standard unit of measure, like somebody used a yardstick to build these. And what we think today, and we've been looking at this since the 70s, is that perhaps the megalithic yard was used on our site. Mm. And they are finding this elsewhere. There's a doctor, I think his name is John Clark from BYU, and he's looking at measurements in South America and Peru, for instance, also in Mexico, and then some of the southern mounds like Poverty Point, Watson Break, down in Louisiana. And he came up with two different measurements, and one of them actually was 83 centimeters. And Mark Eddy sent me the report, and I'm looking at it going, well, what is 83 centimeters? I said, hey, Mark, did you convert that to inches and feet? He goes, no. So I said, well, when I did, it came out to 2.72 feet or 2.73 feet, and it came out to about 3264 in inches. And I said, that's a megalithic yard. But I don't know if Dr. Clark realizes that megalithic yards found in European sites. And it's found that we think at our site too. The table, for instance, the groove on it at the bottom is 2 megalithic yards. The top of the groove is 1.5, and the length of it is 2 megalithic yards. The width of the table at the bottom of the bell shape is 2.5 megalithic yards, and near the top of the table is 2. And the top surface of the table to the bedrock is 1 megalithic yard. Although the stone structures are crude, they're not nice square blocks or rectangular blocks that you find in Egypt or something. So it's a little harder to measure some of the structures. But from what we could do is go out and measure the structures, and it seems to work. Back in Goodwin's day, a guy named Roscoe Whitney, he was from Leominster, Mass. He was an MIT engineer, so a very smart, you know, gentleman. He did all the we have all the data from him. He had a plane table, and he did cross-section profile and plan view of the site. So we have all of site measured back in the 1930s. He just sat there and he just diagrammed everything very carefully. We have all of that, all of his research. And then he said, whoever built the site either didn't know or give a damn about linear measurements, because I've looked at the height, the width, and the length of these structures, and they don't fit imperial measurements of inches, feet, and yards. So that was about 85 years ago that Frost was talking about if the Patty family built this, they weren't using our imperial units, something that a farmer or a shoemaker should be using at that time. It didn't conform to anything. He did not know about the megalithic yard back in the 1930s.
Yeah.
The megalithic yard is something we're looking at, and that LIDAR, because we can see down to a centimeter, is kind of give us a pretty good idea, I think, if that was used, you know, because you can, you know, it's pretty accurate, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, just going back to the table and revisiting that, I popped up on screen a minute ago from the Greek Reporter, an article about a researcher claims ancient Greeks made it to America before Columbus, talking about how the Minoans were aware of the Americas.
And, the Minoans.
And aware of a great continent beyond Europe. So
the Phoenicians had a relationship, too, before the before, what was it, the volcanic explosion,
And to think about that and to think about the fact of a lot of the structure that is there echoes a lot of that kind of structure. Once again, when you're talking about the echoic chamber that leads to the table, everything else, that is hugely reminiscent of Minoan temple, things like that. So fascinating stuff. That article just came out in 2012. I will have to reach out to that researcher and posit that to him and maybe connect you guys. It's always great to talk with you, Dennis, and just hear the constant unraveling that is the mystery of America's Stonehenge. I want to thank you so much for your time, as always, especially on short notice, especially after the holidays. I hope everything goes well for the upcoming season's preparation. And let everybody know where they can go to, because you aren't necessarily fully closed down during the snowy times. You can schedule snowshoe events, all kinds of stuff. Let them know where they can go to schedule events, where they can go to find out more about things happening at America's Stonehenge, Dennis.
Yes, we're open every day, but Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we do snowshoeing in the winter once we got about 6 inches of snow. Our website is stonehengeusa.com. And when they go to that, they can find a phone number if they want to call us. There's an email they can write to us. There's also, we're on Facebook and Instagram. But on the website, if they go to that, they can go down and scroll down and they can find a 12-minute video presentation that we show in our theater. So they can watch that before they even show up and see if it's something they're interested in. It saves a little time at our place too, but we do have the 12-minute video in our visitor center. They can see there. Also, there's a free app download, a mobile app download. And if you download that, you can do a complete virtual tour from your home. If you use it at our site, as you're walking, it will talk to you. It has pictures and text, and it's a nice way to tour the site. So there's a lot of information on the website. And there's even discounted tickets they can buy, and the good tickets are good anytime. They can save a little bit on that. But we're really not closed other than Christmas and Thanksgiving. So it's kind of a year-round thing. So no matter what time of the year you're in the area, you can come up and take a tour.
Fantastic. It is an amazing location. I cannot wait to get up there myself. Thank you so much for your time during this holiday season, Dennis. Please do hold the line real quick while we close things out with our audience. While you are online checking out everything from America's Stonehenge, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can follow us on social media. That is where you can send us your experience. If you're an experiencer of the strange, paranormal, if you have had a cryptid sighting or a UFO UAP experience, if you're a government whistleblower, stop on by curiousrealm.com/story. That will take you to our experiencer page. You can leave an anonymous message there with evidence, pictures, audio, what have you. Thank you so much, everybody, for continuing to tune in. thank you so much for a great first year of Curious Realm. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, until next time, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.